Have your thighs ever chafed? Chafe is no joke, but thanks to Mega Babe, it's also no problem. Mega Babe's Thigh Rescue glides onto skin so that chafe is a thing of the past. Experience what 10,000 five-star reviewers rave about at megababebeauty.com.
Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland
on News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. Fantastic show for you this week because it's one of those types of shows where we take something really mundane like eggs and then we ask a million questions about it, and the answers, as always, are fascinating. So we're going to talk about eggs this week. If you'd like to get in touch with the show, you can email us, science@newstalk.com. You can tweet us. We're at Newstalk Science. First, though, it's time to look back at some of the week's science news. And joining me in studio to discuss the latest findings are Dr. Shane Bergen from UCD and from the University of Galway, Dr. Jessamine Fairfield. Shane, our first story has to do with silk.
Yeah, absolutely. Imagine a silk that can significantly reduce noise from your background. We live in an increasingly noisy world. It's an alarming thing, actually, when you come out of the city and you realize just how loud our background lives are. It's ridiculous. And so the guys in Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT, have published a paper in Advanced Materials recently where they've woven a silk fabric. And the fibers in this fabric are amazing. They're made out of a copolymer, and they're able to demonstrate something called the piezoelectric effect, which means that by applying a small voltage, you can control their movement. And when they weave a fabric made of these fibers together into a cloth, that cloth can repel noise, which is incredible. It acts like a mirror would for light.
That piezoelectric thing, I think that was the inspiration for the bat wings in, was it Batman Begins? Where you pass an electrical current through it and it goes stiff, the fabric goes stiff, and he was able to fly. I think that's the thing, right? You can pass an electrical current through these materials and they can go stiff instantly.
Yeah. Exactly. And that's what's happening here, perhaps inspired by Batman. And so they're able to make the fabric go stiff, which acts like a rigid surface that can reflect the sound just the way a mirror can reflect light. But this fabric is able to go one step further than Batman. It can actually act like a noise cancelling headphone so that it can quickly adapt and respond to incoming noise and create vibrations in the surface of the fabric that can counteract the incoming noise. So they cancel the noise. And that's how your noise-canceling headphones work. They listen to the noise coming in and they produce frequencies that can counteract it. So for every hill, they produce a trough, etc.
I don't understand. I've never understood that. Can you explain how noise-canceling earphones work very briefly?
I can. So all noise is vibration, and vibrations are a series of waves. And if you're able to understand where the hill of the wave is and the trough of the wave is, and then produce a counteracting vibration so that when you add the two of them together, they cancel each other out. That's effectively how those technologies work.
So the benefit of this then is that you can do much bigger spaces, because obviously with noise cancelling headphones, you kind of need to have them on your ears. But with silk, you could use this in, for example, a car or a train or somewhere that was much bigger.
Absolutely. So I'm imagining lots of surfaces that could have this fabric built into it. That you think about our homes, our built environment, etc. Like, you know, the sky's the limit, really, in terms of where you might think this is applicable. And at the first pass, which is incredible here, has shown that they're able to reduce noise by up to 65 decibels, which is a significant noise level. That's like,
wow. You know,
that's the noise of a regular office, right? Just the background noise of an office. So you imagine people sharing workspaces with colleagues and they're like, I'm trying to get stuff done. You people are annoying me. I know you work in an environment like that, Jonathan. So
where people everyone
tend to annoy
me.
You. Yeah. So imagine if you could line the walls and the various surfaces with a fabric that could significantly reduce the noise by that amount.
That's extraordinary. I mean, a vacuum cleaner is 70 decibels. So like you're talking about an extraordinary amount of noise reduction. This sounds like a very 98 FM sort of question to ask, but I'm actually interested because I really hate offensive noise, and it seems to be everywhere. You know, that hum from fridges in restaurants and shops. I'd like to hear from you, 087 1400 106. What is the most annoying noise that you have in your environment that just everyone else accepts? I'd like to get some validation that it's not just me. Okay, our second story, Jessamine, has to do with AI. And you know, we've been talking about how these more powerful models will soon start yielding results. And we really are seeing the fruit of this work now, especially over the past year.
Yeah, so this is a really cool application of AI in a healthcare setting to improve mortality for high-risk heart patients. This is coming out of the National Defense Medical Center in Taiwan. And what they did is they trained an AI system on 450,000 electrocardiogram tests, along with information on the survival of those patients. So basically saying, you know, we measured this person's heart, here's what's happened. Huge, huge, huge number of tests for the training set. And what that did is it produced basically just a percentile score of risk, where they said, okay, above 95% is a high risk person. And then they did a randomized clinical trial with 16,000 patients at two different hospitals across 39 different physicians, where wow, they would do this electrocardiogram, this ECG, upload it by the nurse, and then basically the AI system looked at it and just flagged to the doctor whether it was considered high risk. So basically just saying, hey, take another look at this person, or don't worry about it. And what it did is it actually reduced the overall deaths for these high-risk patients by 31%. Like, that's a huge change. And I mean, like a drug manufacturer, they would kill to see these numbers, right? Like in a clinical trial. I mean, this is such a huge change. And actually the overall, or the deaths specifically from heart issues for those patients were reduced by 90%. So this is just like, you know, an extra little check of existing scans that are already being taken on these patients to say, hey, look at this guy again. And it has such a huge change. Like, to me, this is a really, really powerful application of AI, and it should definitely become standard across a lot of different healthcare settings.
I mean, that is extraordinary, that sort of a gain. And it is the real promise of a technology like this, that we could see a reduction so quickly of something. And it makes sense that that something like ECG, you know, our hearts giving off such a very distinct fingerprint or very distinct pattern, that the computers could pick up something that humans can't. And I guess, I mean, there's an ethical obligation now for cardiac hospitals around the world to consider employing this as quickly as possible. This is a trial that presumably the hospital is going to continue. Do we know about that? I mean,
it is, but yeah, it's part of the defense medical system in Taiwan. So I think they're able to roll stuff out quite quickly. But yeah, I think as you said, this is so successful that in a way they do have an ethical obligation to use it in as many settings as possible, because it makes such a big difference and it's non-invasive, right? Like, they're not giving you an extra drug or doing an extra procedure. It's literally just taking data that they're already collecting and having a look at it in a different way. And it's just amazing that they can make such a big difference.
Do we know about longer outcomes for these patients? Because obviously, you know, some of those patients would have had a cardiac event very quickly and that would have been the cause of their death. Saving them that day obviously makes for great stats, but longer term, do we know 3 months, 6 months, a year survival?
No, we don't know that yet. I mean, this is basically looking at like their time in the hospital.
Right.
But I think, yeah, the long-term follow-up would be super worthwhile as well. And I think it's also interesting to think about, like, can this translate to other types of illnesses, and just look at data that's already being collected in the hospital and whether there's any red flags that we're missing.
I mean, if you think about the potential for this, there is, of course, the patient outcome, which is paramount. But on top of that, there is a prioritization of those critical people involved in the care of a cardiac patient, and not just the doctors, but the entire team. And we know that cardiac is one of those therapeutic areas where it's a revolving door. If you have a heart attack, you know, a large percentage of those patients do not make it past the third year. So extraordinary science, and great to hear a really positive news story from AI. Let's hope that gets rolled out very quickly. Our third story has to do with CRISPR. And again, a new technology that talked about a huge amount of promise, but we are now seeing the fruits of gene editing in eye patients. Shane.
Yeah, just to point out, CRISPR was first mentioned in the literature in 1987. Incredible. The first paper was 2002. The first commercial use was 2012. And it's now, you know, in recent years that we're starting to see it being really applied in meaningful ways in clinical trials. So I guess the lesson from that is technology and science are, you know, great bedfellows, but they do take time, you know. And so investing in research that might seem completely wacky can take decades to turn into things that are real. And the previous story I spoke about is another example of that from MIT. But in this particular study, 14 people took part in what's called a gene editing trial, had the great name Brilliance. And there were 14 people that have a very rare inherited retinal degeneration disease. Very, very rare, but it does affect them in significant ways. They can be blind or have very limited vision. And what they did was they looked at a gene editing tool that uses the CRISPR technology called Edit 101. And it kind of tracks and traces to a particular segment of DNA within a gene, and it can switch it off. And by doing that in this study, they were able to significantly improve the quality of sight for people living with this condition. They were looking in particular at a mutation of something called gene 290. This gene has instructions within it to create a protein that's critical for sight. And so without it, you would struggle to see. And they did find improvement, right? Again, I stress it's 14 people, right? So these clinical trials tend to work on those small scales. And they found that almost 80% of that group, so 11 out of the 14, showed improvement on one of four measured outcomes. So they asked them to see how their visual acuity improved. They looked to see how their vision of color points improved. They looked to see how they navigated a maze. And they also asked them about the quality of their life. And so 11 of the 14 said that they saw improvement across two of those four outcomes. Six of the 14 saw improvement beyond that. And I it's also great to see that most of the adverse effects in this trial of a small group were very moderate. So there wasn't any unforeseen circumstances, albeit with a small group. It's pretty cool that they're actually at the stage of using this gene editing technology at the clinical stage and improving people's lives.
Very cool stuff. Okay, Jessamine, our final story has to do with squirrels. Everybody loves them, but this is not a good story.
No, well, everybody loves squirrels, but this is a story about how if you were a human living in the medieval times in a city, you might need to be a little bit careful of them. And the reason is leprosy. So leprosy, which is also known as Hansen's disease, is something that used to be a really big deal and is easily treatable with antibiotics now. But it's a disease that's caused by a bacteria, the Mycobacterium leprae, which basically causes all sorts of horrible, like skin, nerve, eye infections, like really, really awful disease that now mainly just happens in Southeast Asia and a few other places. So it's still interesting to think about how we can treat this and where it comes from. Researchers at the University of Leicester have now shown that leprosy in medieval times was very much correlated to red squirrels living in medieval cities and around them, and not necessarily living, but dead due to the fur trade. So this is an interesting stat that I learned from this story. In medieval times, in the year 1384, 377,000 squirrel skins were imported to England, like just in that one year. That's so many squirrels, like so many squirrels.
It's a lot of squirrels. So, I'm not going to argue with that.
What these researchers did is they looked at the city of Winchester, which was an important medieval city, and it had both a large furrier industry and also a leper hospital. And they were able to compare archaeological samples from three humans who lived with leprosy to samples from a squirrel whose remains were in a furrier pit. Both the humans and the squirrel lived about 1,000 years ago. And they were able to show that actually the strain of the leprosy bacteria that was in both was an extremely good match. It was a much better match than it was from, say, humans then to humans now, or squirrels then to squirrels now. And there have been previous research that showed that the leprosy in these medieval humans was similar to leprosy in red squirrels today. But this, like showing that they were that similar at the same time, is super interesting. It doesn't necessarily say whether we caught leprosy from squirrels or they caught it from us. So that's a little bit troubling. Squirrels were also kept as pets at the time. So, like, really, medieval life, much more squirrel-centric than I had previously realized. like, it's pretty interesting though, right? Because I think in recent years, we've become so aware that like that the animals in our environment can harbor bacteria and viruses that can affect us and vice versa. And so this kind of implies, right, we should look at wildlife in surrounding areas that still do have leprosy to see, are there reservoirs of the bacteria? Could that improve how we treat it? And also, I mean, just give squirrels a little bit of a wide berth is all I'm saying.
What on earth gave rise to this investigation in the first place? Who went leprosy? It's probably the squirrels. Like, that is a strange jump. Was there any reason why they thought there might be a link?
I think partly just like the volume of squirrels right. processed and included in daily
a lot
life.
Of squirrels.
But no, I don't know. Was there a table or something where they're like cows? No, sheep? No, cats? No. I've got it. Let's look at squirrels. Mm. Like real late night in the lab.
A really interesting story.
Yeah. Interesting.
And that's got to be the quote of the program. I didn't realize medieval life was so squirrel-centric. Dr. Jessamine Fairfield from the University of Galway and from UCD, Dr. Shane Bergen, thank you very much. All right, on the way, do not go anywhere because we're going to talk about eggs. And that might seem like a really dull subject to you because you just think you know everything that is interesting to know about eggs. Nothing could be further from the truth. And you can hold your next family meeting or your mates down in the pub in thrall with the stuff you're going to learn in the next 50 minutes. I promise you, it's worth your time. Stay with us. Now, it was actually Aristotle writing in the 4th century that said, which came first, the chicken or the egg? One of Western philosophy's greatest minds, he considered this query to be an example of an infinite sequence with no true beginning. But our next guest thinks Aristotle was full of crap and wasn't even asking the right question to begin with. Jules Howard is a zoological correspondent and author of Infinite Life, a revolutionary story of eggs, evolution and life on Earth. He joins me now. Jules, I said it at the beginning of the program, eggs are something that I just hadn't really thought about. And now I'm completely fascinated. So as I always do, let's start off with what we define as an egg, because we start our lives in eggs, but they're very different to chicken's eggs. What exactly is an egg?
You can think of an egg as a kind of like an organic vessel that sends genes forwards in time. So it's like a time travel device that always sends, yeah, genes moving forward through time. So it's a handy way that animals can survive hard times, so seasonal change, bad winters or rough oceans, and allow their genes to sort of regrow in a new formation with the genes of another partner. So it's partly about surviving hard times, but it's also about mixing genes up. So the role of the sperm, you know, and the egg is obviously a vital importance in the story of animals.
Yeah, and it's an interesting definition. I did not expect you to say that. In terms of the egg holds genetic material, as does the sperm, right? Is that the case in all animals?
Yeah. So you could say that the egg and the sperm both got the same aim. They're both carrying genes and they're going to combine. But the egg provides the environment for the embryo to grow. So that's another nice way to define what is, you know, when I think of an egg, I don't know about you, I just automatically go to a chicken's egg. But actually, you know, at its most basic, it is basically a storage site for the embryo to grow and to continue that cycle again.
And these eggs that are created, obviously some are laid and are hard, and others complete the egg cycle within the animal, as in a live birth. Can you talk to me about what the difference is there biologically and why that happens?
Yeah, it's actually really interesting. I when I was learning zoology, 20 years ago or so, it was very much a kind of like, oh, you know, very rarely will we find that, you know, eggs become internalized in some parts of the animal family tree. But actually researching this book, it's quite common, actually. It's happened 150 times in bony animals, so animals with bones, 150 times that eggs have become internalized and the shells have been become very thin. And eventually, you know, these eggs have no shells at all and the embryo grows within the sort of egg tube itself. So, yeah, it obviously happened in our ancestors, the ancestors of all mammals. It happens often in sharks. It's really, really, really common among reptiles. So lizards particularly can move between these strategies. So what we think of as quite a complex thing, actually, it kind of isn't. It's just about the eggshell thinning to such a degree that the babies can grow kind of naked within the egg tube, which is, I mean, it's like I say, I was really struck by how often that happens. And also, you know, even the umbilical cord and the placenta, you know, placenta is basically like a sort of angry fire hose that connects up to the mother and absorbs nutrients kind of directly. So it is genuinely really awe-inspiring how often that happens. Mostly, you know, in sharks, for instance, which are probably best studied, in sharks, it's about producing babies of a larger size. So a great white shark, for instance, if a great white shark produced tiny babies, if it produced eggs that produced quite small babies, the babies would be eaten. But by keeping the egg, by keeping the embryo inside the shark's body, it means that great white sharks can give birth to sharks that are like 2 meters long. So they're already kind of top of the food chain.
Wait a second. I thought sharks laid mermaids' purses.
Yeah. So about half lay mermaids' purses, the smaller species especially. And then the larger ones, you know, produce much larger offspring and they are live birth. I know, it's amazing.
I'm going to come back to this phrase egg tube, because it's the first time I've ever heard that phrase. But before we do that, what are the evolutionary advantages of going, you know, to moving the egg? I mean, actually, which came first? Was it hard eggs or was it internalized soft eggs?
Yeah, that's a great, great question. So looking at across the fossil record, we see that maybe 600 million years ago, before there were animals as we know it, before the famous Cambrian explosion, we find fossils of very, very simple eggs, probably from jellyfish-like animals. So this was a period in Earth's history when animals looked like kind of floating balloon animals. They didn't have brains or stomachs or much else. And essentially, these eggs were just sort of, just like jellyfish do today, they're just sort of pumped out of the body through a pore, through just a simple hole. And lots of animals, you know, especially a lot of mollusks and sea urchins as well do this today. Mm. They just basically jettison their eggs, you know, into the water and the eggs have got to kind of hope for the best. But then in the Cambrian explosion, when we see the very first earliest fish-like animals and crustaceans and especially mollusks, we see that in some lineages, in some parts of the family tree, yeah, the eggs get kind of a treatment center before they're sent on their way. And that's basically what an egg tube is. It's a simple tube that dresses the egg as it comes out. So it can basically squirt on chemicals that harden and become a very primitive shell. And then much later on, you know, in the last 200 years, you get the much thicker eggshell in some groups, especially birds and dinosaurs. So, yeah, the egg started off soft and small and moved on from there, especially, like I say, in about the last 350 million years. So It's really fascinating. So some animals stick with it today. So very jellyfish, for instance, still pump out their eggs in their millions, as do corals. And even some fish like the, you know, the ocean sunfish, this giant fish that looks like a dustbin lid.
Yeah.
And one of them can produce like a, you know, a million eggs in one go. They just spray them out into the water and off they go. So it's a kind
amazing
of
the world is not filled with sunfish then.
Yeah, and that's it. It's all about this natural equation. You know, it's better for sunfish to produce. The chances of their baby surviving is better for them just to make it a lottery, essentially one in a million, than it is to evolve to keep the eggs nice and safe in the body. But also temperature seems to make a difference. So there are some lizards, in fact, the common lizard that we have in Ireland and across the UK is in some parts of the world, this lizard on a mountainside will give birth to live babies. And then down at the bottom of the mountain, the same species will lay eggs.
No.
Yeah, it's amazing. So
Wow. There
is a kind of weird fluidity to egg laying that we just don't, you know, textbooks don't really do it justice sometimes, you know?
Mm. I, when you talk about egg tubes, I presume we have these in fallopian tubes. Is that the same thing?
Yeah, fallopian tubes, you could say that's where the egg's made, and then it's dressed in the uterus, which is basically, you know, our version of the egg tube.
Right, okay. So, and then you said the tube is to cover it in sort of substances. What are these substances, and how does an egg and a chicken get hard?
Yes, it's a great question. And like I say, I'm embarrassed that as a zoologist, I never really considered it before before researching this. So yeah, when you're holding a chicken's egg in your hand, a boiled egg, let's say, that hard crystalline structure is, yeah, prepped up in the egg tube. So I now think of the egg tube of a chicken a bit like a car wash. So within the walls of the egg tube are loads of little, almost like spray cans, glands that are full of liquids. So at first, the egg in the chicken doesn't have a shell. It's just an amorphous blob with a yolk.
Yeah.
And then it passes these first nozzles, and they are basically nozzles like in a car wash. And they put that thin layer on. It's almost like silly string. And that's the layer you see just under the shell. Have you ever seen that? You sort of peel off the egg shell.
Albumen, is it?
It's a kind of very thin layer just above the albumen.
Right.
And it's like parchment. It's a bit leathery, really. Okay, and then next stage, it's going through the egg tube and it's sprayed again, and this time with sort of foamy stuff, essentially, and that's a calcium-rich custard, essentially. And then that hardens, that's given time to harden before the egg moves down to the next bit where it's literally sprayed. So it's given a sort of a polish or a sheen, and sometimes in birds like blackbirds, it's given a blue dye as it passes through.
What?
Yeah, I know.
I'm sorry, Jules. There's one thing that really begs belief here, and that is chickens aren't that long. Like they don't have six compartments for an egg, as far as I can see. Is this just very small movements, or how does that work? I mean, you're talking. It sounds like you've got like four different departments here.
Well, essentially, you are right. Their egg tube is coiled, so it's a little bit like a corkscrew.
Right.
It gives it a bit of extra length as it moves through. But you're exactly right. A lot of this stuff goes on in discrete sort of chambers. So mostly it happens, it's kind of like four corners as it goes out, a bit like a zigzag.
Wow.
Each corner has got a different kind of role in this egg creation. So yeah, in some birds, it's like pencil etchings. At the moment, there's a lot of yellow hammers around, and like their eggs look like they've been drawn on with pencils. It's really amazing. And then just as the egg comes out, it's given one final sort of polish, like a glaze, which basically stops bacteria and other microorganisms from landing on the egg and trying to sort of, you know, parasitize it. So it is far more complicated and beautiful than we give it much thought, really. But that's not just chickens, of course. That applies to, you know, all birds. And actually many dinosaurs had coloured eggs as well, we now realise. So the same chemicals we see in blackbird eggs are the same chemicals used in many of the dinosaur groups as well, including Velociraptor, which is just so cool.
Amazing. So this is one of the advantages. It keeps out bacteria. What are the other advantages of having an egg versus keeping it internal and laying, giving birth to a live young that can just go off and do like a foal does, not like a human does because we're rubbish, but like a foal just jumps out of the womb and gets going.
Yeah, it's a great shout, because actually birds, it is very restrictive, of course, having eggs. You know, they needed, in most birds species, you know, the males and females have to hang around together to raise their babies. And in fact, that's why we have bird song. That's why you hear that at the moment, is essentially they're establishing a territory because they have to, because their babies are there, their chicks are there, and they need looking after. So essentially, in birds, we think eggshell is very useful because it allowed their dinosaur ancestors to make bigger eggs. So the eggshell is a little bit like a framework. It adds engineering structure to the egg so it doesn't kind of collapse on itself.
Mm.
And the other benefit, of course, is it's is fairly well protected against, you know, invaders, you know, microorganisms and the like. So that's one of the good things. Also, eggs can be put in trees and other places where they might need to be more hard wearing compared to other reptiles. But to be honest, you know, that question itself is actually fascinating, because one of the strange things we don't see with birds is we don't see them. Like, if you think of, I mentioned reptiles like lizards and snakes, they seem able in some species to kind of go backwards, if you like, which is rare in evolution. We don't often see that, but snakes that give birth can go back to laying eggs, which is incredible. But we don't seem to see that in birds. So we don't know if that's a physiological thing, like they've gone so far down this evolutionary avenue, they can't go back. We don't see that in mammals either. So we don't see mammals reverting to the egg-laying type, you know. The echidna and the platypus that lay eggs, you know, they went their own way, you know, almost 200 million years ago.
And they ain't coming back.
No,
of course, the other benefit of the egg is that you can stop feeding that animal and carrying it around as it gets heavier and heavier, you just leave it in the nest and you go off and do your work and come back. And it feeds and looks after itself, of course.
And that's exactly right, yeah. So that's one of the, probably the main benefits to birds is obviously for them it's about their weight, you know, flight weight.
What?
But it's interesting, we haven't seen in penguins, for instance, you know, we haven't seen, any sort of move towards internal babies like we see, you know, in a lot of whales, for instance, and also in ichthyosaurs and other reptiles that lived in the Jurassic. A lot of them went from egg laying to producing live babies, just partly to protect them from the cold. So who knows? I don't know, 100 million years, we might have birds that can, you know, give birth, maybe penguins that can give birth. But right now, it seems to be a kind of really interesting universal part of bird life, you know, on this planet.
What sort of mass does a bird or an animal create in terms of the eggs? Because they seem like there's a lot of material. Like, if you think about that chicken, I was thinking about the chicken's egg, and like, you can't fit a lot of eggs into a chicken. You get lots of eggs come out of it. And I was lucky enough to be on the coast of French Guiana helping track some leatherback turtles once. And I managed to see these turtles go up onto the beach, and they would pump out these giant eggs. And there was like nearly 80 of them I counted in one. Like, that's a lot of eggs. How big does the mass of an egg lay compared to the adult? Is it rare for these animals to have, just a small egg if they're quite large? Or do big animals have loads of large eggs?
Yeah, lovely, lovely question. So there is a lot of diversity, a lot of variation, as you say. So the either end of the spectrum is the largest egg, which is the ostrich egg, is about, it sits about 20, 25 centimetres high. So it's football sized almost.
Yeah.
And those eggs that the ostrich lays, I think they lay about 15 eggs in one go, that takes up just 2% of their body weight. So it's the biggest egg. But by terms of body weight, it's actually quite a small egg.
I'm sorry, stop. 15 eggs the size of a football, one go from an ostrich. Are you sure?
No, well, over a few days. So most birds don't just pop, sort of, I was going to say parp, which I'm not sure.
No, I don't know if that's a real word. No, but they have 15 inside them to then lay birth, to give birth to them.
If you imagine it's like a queue. So the egg tube is queuing up and they're coming out, you know, it depends on the species, but it might be every day. Sometimes it might be, you know, longer than that.
Okay. And so that's 2% of the body weight. And then the other end of the scale?
Other end of the scale is a kiwi, of all things, which is another flightless bird, New Zealand bird. They lay a single egg, and get this, it takes up about 20% of their body, and their whole skeleton, essentially, the ribs are really small on it. So it basically carries around this, it's like a human giving birth to a beach ball, basically. And that's a single egg. So we think, interestingly, that the kiwi's gone down that journey because, you know, traditionally in New Zealand, when there wasn't ground predators, obviously mammals, apart from bats, mammals didn't get to New Zealand until quite recently. So it was in the kiwi's reproductive interest to produce a large baby because basically that landscape, nice and safe. So you might as well just invest in a big baby.
Speaking to you, I have so many more questions for you. But I want to finish off with the question that we sort of started with, which is the chicken and the egg. And I guess, Jules, by the way we're talking, the egg tube must have come first, right? From what you're sort of saying. But if an egg tube came first, what was it there for?
For me, that's become the better question. Yeah, what came first, the egg or the egg tube? I think it's a question, you know, you mentioned Aristotle, and I think it still has got, it's still a paradox. There's still philosophical layers to it. I mean, you're right. Egg tubes go back all the way to probably the earliest reptiles. So we're talking right back into the Carboniferous, basically, 340 million years ago. So yeah, egg tubes in our lineage, very, very old indeed. But obviously insects have egg tubes as well, you know, and they're 400, almost 400 million years old. So egg tubes, as I said before, really, you know, looking at fossils from the Cambrian period, you know, when the earliest crustaceans were swimming around, a lot of them had quite simple egg tubes as well, and they planted their eggs on their kind of undersides and kind of glued them there. So now we're going back, goodness, we're going back sort of 500 million years. So I would say egg tube still beats is still very ancient indeed. But the fact that across the animal family tree, so if you go from distantly related jellyfish right through to sharks, right through to humans or, you know, pygmy kangaroos, you see eggs and you see sperm. So looking at the DNA within sperm, looking at the genes that control sperm production, they're so widespread. We think that the sperm and by extension the egg goes back, get ready, goes back about 1,000 million years.
Wow.
So the egg is truly ancient.
So it looks like it might indeed be the egg, but more research required, as they say. Really fascinating book, filled with so many interesting facts about something you may not have even considered before, the story of eggs. It's called Infinite Life, A Revolutionary Story of Eggs, Evolution and Life on Earth. Jules Howard, thanks for your time.
Oh, thanks, Jonathan. Cheers.
I love that. I really loved that. There's just probably so many subjects that we haven't yet touched on. Eggs is one of them. We just haven't talked about eggs before. If you can think of one that you really like us to cover, because we did hair is fascinating, eyes are fascinating. I mean, you could just look around you and go, I wonder what that is about. And you'll find just amazing things. We did the materials, we did metals before. Fascinating stuff. Producer Aidan McKelvey joins me to go through some of your comments, which you can, as I say, email science@newstalk.com. How are you?
I'm very good. Yeah. Okay. I love that as well. Like, there's the cool thing about sort of modern life is we're all quite specialized. So there's anything you can pick and you don't know anything about it. Like, you know how your TV turns on, you know how your cooker works, you know what like the food is, but that's it. You have a surface level knowledge of everything, but like a deep knowledge of virtually nothing. And that's why you listen to Future Proof.
Well, some people are an inch deep and a mile wide, and some people are an inch wide and a mile deep. I am an inch wide and an inch deep. And that's why I really love my job.
I thought you were going to say, because I find that's probably why I'm good at, I like this job as well, is that I like to know a bit about everything.
Yeah.
But I just can't get my head around, you know, some of the scientists we've had on. The one that always comes back to me, which is really funny, is Andreas Hegnall, I think was his name, and he did a whole piece with us on the evolution of the anus.
Yeah.
This guy has studied the anus for, you know, anus, decades, and he's going to give me 20 minutes of gold that
yeah,
I don't
and
have
he
to
did,
do.
And he did, and he absolutely did.
And maybe you'll find that in your Future Proof Gold.
Okay, on to some of your comments from last week. We were talking about ant colonies with John Whitfield, and Cormac says, I hope humans are top of that list of worst invasive species. Because we were saying that ants actually are almost better than humans. These super colony ants, which can travel like an entire length of a country and recognize each other from one end to the other. Incredible stuff. I suppose we are worst invasive species.
Yeah, well, we transported them. So indirectly, it's our fault they're there as well.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, like, what makes an invasive species bad? Like, I mean, it ruins an ecology. We do that. Difficult to get rid of. Yeah, I'd say probably we are. Even from a scientific point of view, I'd say if you looked at, you know, all of the invasive species over time, like even bacteria and viruses keep most of their hosts alive, you know.
Yeah.
Sean McCreevenock says, can this guy tell us how to get rid of ants? I mean,
he kind of said, you can't.
You can't get, you know, yeah, big lots you can't. But can't you just leave like a little... Did I see something, a little trail of sugar at the door? Something like that.
Yeah, we'll just have like a billion ants or a billion ants walking out your door.
Yeah, I mean, Anya Nicarocti has texted in. She says, we do tend to look at ourselves very negatively when it comes to other species. But when we see something is endangered or at risk many times, we've brought them back from the brink really quickly. We can be good for the world around us when we remember we are part of it and use our talents for it. That's a good argument for not being the worst invasive species, because name one other species that has saved another species completely altruistically.
Yeah, name one other species who cares. Like, you could make an argument that they're capable of. We care. We just accidentally messed it up for century after century, but we're starting to turn things around.
When it's convenient. When it's convenient and we have the time and we have committed people who are dedicated to that cause, then we do.
Yeah.
Those factors have to sort of be there.
We're not all bad, is all I'm saying.
Yeah, for sure. on Tuesday, we're going to be talking about the Europa Clipper mission, which is aiming to find, it'll be about sort of a hack to try and find life on Europa. And I was just thinking, imagine, like, we're all, you know, we go through all of this, imagining that we're just not going to find life. All these missions that we send at Mars, and we go and we send Curiosity, and they have like five follow-up missions to see if we can find any traces of life. We do that with the knowledge that there's 99.9% chance that we're not going to find life on our solar system. But imagine if we did. Like, imagine if we did. How crazy would it be to pick up a newspaper or get a notification on your phone that says, life elsewhere in this solar system or in this universe? It would just be insane. Because you'd have to then allow all sorts of life. If it's not just us, it's giant blue floaty things, it's tiny little stick dudes that can smoke cigarettes and... I don't know. I mean, I don't know what I'm doing here.
Who can smoke cigarettes? I didn't expect it to go there.
I don't know. But I'm just trying to think of like what would be in an alien movie. And I was thinking like Men in Black and something like that. Like, did we have to allow all types, all shapes and all sizes and everything? If we can allow, if we can find even the tiniest bacterium on another planet.
Yeah.
Blows a wad up.
I've had actually a tantalizing experience of what that would feel like, that sci-fi moment of looking at your phone. It was in 2020, in that brief period, I think it was towards the end of the summer, like August or thereabouts, where it looked like, oh, this pandemic, Ireland are sorting it right out, and we were allowed kind of move outside our counties. And I did the Wicklow Way walk. Uh-huh. And on the end of one of the days, we were sitting there waiting to get a taxi, I think, back to our B&B at the end of like a long walk. And the notification came through, Irish Times notification, so like reputable newspaper. And it was some, the headline was something like, scientists find life on Venus. And we were in the middle of nowhere.
I'd say the science editor had a day off that day.
He probably did. But we were in the middle of nowhere. And I was like, no, no way, no way. And my partner, Mona, was like, what? What? She thought something bad had happened. I was going like, I can't believe I've lived to see this day. I was like,
this headline
is life. They just found life on Venus. This is incredible. And it did have, I had that brief moment before I read the article, obviously, where I was like, wow, I'm going to live to see life on other planets. And that changes like religiously, philosophically, like sort of everything about the universe. And I quickly tapped in. And then Mona was then like really excited as well. And then she had to watch my face fall as I read the article. Like, yeah, it's not that exciting.
Yeah, no. I just don't think we're ever going to see it. I do think it's out there. I just don't think we're going to find it.
Well, like you said, the Europa Clipper thing could easily find a bacteria. I don't think we'll find like things swimming around.
No.
But if you find the bacteria, that's it. It's done deal. There are aliens everywhere, because if you get two in the same solar system.
Because you can't get like bacteria to Earth, from Earth to there. Like, you could have contamination.
You could, but again, if you found that in the Europa Clipper mission, still within our lifetime, they'd be able to clarify whether or not it was connected to us or not.
That's what we're going to be talking about on the next Future Proof podcast, which is in the feed where you find this podcast. If you like the show, by the way, subscribe, rate, like, share with your friends. We like that. Thanks to Aidan McKelvey, producer, and thanks to you for listening. We'll be back with more Future Proof, as I say, on Tuesday. In the meantime, stay curious.
Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland.
Sunday morning at 10 on News Talk.